looking good. Ah, hello, folks. Karl Marx here. I was just taking some selfies. I look particularly good today. The humidity is just right for my hair. One more. Okay, two more. Ah, wunderbar. Looking good, Karl.
Want to learn more about the Marxist agenda and other important stuff? Listen to The Ultimate Remedy with L.B. Bork, Tuesdays, 6 p.m. Eastern. Right here on Revolution Radio.
All right. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Welcome, everyone, here on December the 15th in the year 2020. And welcome to The Ultimate Remedy. LB is a bit under the weather and couldn't make it tonight. I'm Mike Gatti, and I'm here, and we're going to have a great discussion tonight. Have good old trusty Dave Scorpio here with us, and we have DW, the retired airline pilot, and our friend Robert Hudson from out there in the Vegas area, Reno area now, I think it is. So, what's going on, Dave?
Well, I'm hanging in there, Mike. It's a crazy world. Things to be seems to be getting stranger by the day, but I'm hanging in there.
All right. Moving to the farthest away first. Robert, how are you tonight, young man?
I am well. Thank you for asking, and definitely thank you for inviting me to the reindeer game. I appreciate that.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. And DW, sign on from Alabama there, would you please, sir?
Oh, hi, y'all. Looking forward to tonight. Lots to talk about. we can explore the idea of exchanging old lies for new lies. And happy to be here.
Well, yeah. Are you tired of the old lies yet, DW?
Yeah, the old lies are worn out. We need some new ones.
Need some new ones, huh? All right. One of the things we kind of discussed for a subject tonight was the myth of constitutional rights. And we have, and I see it all the time throughout social media and emails and everything else, people talking about their constitutional rights being violated. And there has to be some remedy, and there, you know, we need to do this or we need to do that. DW, in your opinion, are there any constitutional rights to lean on?
Well, I've thought about this quite a bit, and I went to my my pocket constitution, and contained in there, there was some things about the government, and then there was something in there about us, and it was called the Bill of Rights. And I've read through them pretty good on several occasions. And I can't see where any of them have been respected from the government.
Well, it's my contention, DW, that this was all a master plan. And to throw a little history into the mix, the Federalists, or those who would soon call themselves Federalists, controlled the Congress under the Articles of Confederation. But they had a problem. They could not implement their taxing scheme. They could not get the taxing they wanted. Which they wanted unlimited taxes from unlimited sources, and they wanted those to be able to support their wealthy aristocratic programs. And they wanted to make these ventures and everything else, but they wanted everybody else to pay for it. And so they were trying to get this through the Articles of Confederation. And they kept proposing these legislative acts over and over and over again. But every time they did, they bumped into that ugly Article 13 of the Articles of Confederation, which said that all 13 states had to agree to such legislation. And the Federalist, or Nationalist as they were then before they became Federalist, or Monarchist even in some instances, they kept trying and trying, and finally they had one that they thought they had it done. The only holdout seemed to be Rhode Island. And they were really excited because they thought this time they had it made. Robert Morris even wrote this time in a letter, this time we have it. This time we have our taxes that we need. We'll have everything worked out. And then Rhode Island began to balk a little bit. The legislature in Rhode Island was going, nah, I'm not sure we're going to vote for this. So the good old Federalist, Robert Morris and group and Alexander Hamilton and others started sending delegates, not delegates, but started sending people north to actually, well, members of Congress, sending them to Rhode Island to kind of strong arm Rhode Island into voting. And then they would have their taxing scheme on board with the Articles of Confederation. Problem was, is that while they were trying to coerce Rhode Island into signing on to this taxing scheme, Virginia up and withdrew their ratification. So they were foiled again. So then they decided, this was in 1786, so they decided, hey, if this isn't working, we probably should just go ahead and get a new form of government, because we've got to have some way to get these taxes on the people to where they can't, one state can't stop us in the process. So therefore, they had been thinking about another convention from that point forward. Go ahead.
Well, the taxes they were trying to get the authority to levy, were these just on businesses? They weren't on the day-to-day person, was it?
No, there was no direct taxation. There was no capitation tax in those taxes. But what they were trying to get was trying to get an impost. And if we go back in our history a little bit before that, it is very intuitive to know to whom these debts were owed that they were trying to get taxes to pay. And you will find that the people who were owed the most money were the stockholders in the first bank called the Bank of North America, because these were the people who had loaned money to the government. Most of them were residents of the 13 states. And so they were trying to get their money back that they had loaned through a scheme that Robert Morris had conducted. So they were trying to recover their money. But they wanted their money to be paid. They wanted to be paid in full, and they wanted to be paid in specie. And so that is why they were controlling a government to try to get taxes to pay them the money that they claimed that they were owed. So it's really a surreptitious criminal conspiracy is what Sentinel called it. So they were trying to recover this money, but they couldn't get the states to do it. But it was an impost, and there was no direct taxation at that time. So, yes,
well,
you're right.
Michael.
Go ahead.
Michael, take that word impost and unwind that a little bit for people that may not be familiar with it,
well,
including me.
An impost was basically a tax on goods. You could tax goods. They also wanted an excise tax in there as well, which had been implemented in Massachusetts under their Constitution of 1780, which caused the Shays Rebellion. So that was, again, they wanted that for the whole 13 colonies. They wanted that to where they could recover that money. Go ahead.
Well, so if we thought of an impost tax like an internal tariff on goods.
Right.
Or an
external tariff as well. You could get exports and imports with an impost.
Okay. So, I mean, we all understand. I think most of us understand that an excise tax is something like when we buy a fuel. Fuel being an excise tax is an excise tax, and so that's reasonable. How would the impost tax be really different than the excise tax?
Well, it would just be on goods that were imported or exported. So an excise tax could be imposed, like the excise tax was imposed on whiskey. And, of course, then that led to the Whiskey Rebellion once the government was operating. But we're talking about before we got to the Constitution that allowed that. So
So if Pennsylvania, if the guys in Pennsylvania wanted to export their hooch over to Canada, they would have had to pay an impost tax then. Is that
right? Mm-hmm.
Okay. Gotcha.
So that is an impost. So these taxes were not working. So these people who would later call themselves Federalists decided, hey, we need us a new form of government, but we're not going to be able to talk people into giving us a new form of government. So we're going to run a scam and tell them we're going to amend the Articles of Confederation to meet the exigencies that we are facing. And these financial crises, which they call it, which today everyone will tell you, if you ask them why the Articles of Confederation were weak, well, it was all about commerce. Well, what they really mean is it was about taxes. And they couldn't raise enough money through the taxes. And they said, well, America owed so much money. Well, who did they owe the money to? And when you ask that question, people can't answer you, because the stockholders of the Bank of North America were never listed, not publicly. So it wasn't a matter of public information. So then we go ahead.
Well, is that a little bit like the Federal Reserve today from 1913? We don't really know who the stockholders are.
Well, that is exactly the same thing. The Bank of North America, you didn't know who the stockholders were. And then when you got the First Bank of the United States, the stockholders were not listed. So, yes, it is the exact same thing.
So this run up to the Constitutional Convention in 1787, you're saying this is a bait and switch.
That would be a good definition of a bait and switch, because that's exactly what they were doing. And so they go to the state legislators and say, okay, elect delegates, send delegates to Philadelphia, and let's amend the Articles of Confederation, which is what they were sent there to do. But these people who call them Federalists, led by James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and Robert Morris and James Wilson, these people had decided that there was no way. They were not going to do the Articles of Confederation. They never intended to amend the Articles of Confederation. So they get to Philadelphia, and the Articles of Confederation aren't mentioned until Luther Martin brings it up and says, hey, wait a minute, that's not what we're here for. We're supposed to be amending the Articles of Confederation. Well, they just won't work. So we need to come up with this new Constitution. So the new Constitution was a scam and a fraud. Their efforts to be there was a scam and a fraud. But anyway, today everybody loves it because, you know, it was endowed by God, according to so many people. But what they put together was so let's look at, we're talking about rights. So the convention in the summer of 1787, from May until September, they said unequivocally, no Bill of Rights. They voted on it, and the vote was 13-0. No Bill of Rights. So if the Federalists who controlled the Constitutional Convention said no Bill of Rights, that I don't understand why people can't understand that they did not intend to allow a Bill of Rights, which they didn't. So that is why George Mason said he would rather chop off his right arm than sign that Constitution without a Bill of Rights. Elbridge Gerry also would not sign it without a Bill of Rights. Edmund Randolph would not sign it without a Bill of Rights. So we had three people who refused to sign it.
How about Sam Adams?
Sam Adams wasn't there.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Now, Sam Adams was never invited to be there, and there's probably a reason for that.
He's making beer.
Yeah, and John Hancock was not invited to be there. Paul Revere was not invited to be there. But good old Patrick Henry was invited, and he succinctly said, "I smell a rat leaning toward a monarchy in Philadelphia," and he refused to go.
Mike, who was in charge of who was supposed to be invited to this?
Well, they had tried the Annapolis Convention the year before, and they were frustrated because they called for a convention to do this to meet the exigencies of the Articles of Confederation in Annapolis. The problem was only five states sent delegates. They had the convention in Annapolis, Maryland, and Maryland didn't even show up. So they only had five states, so they couldn't get their scheme over in Annapolis. So then James Madison, conferring with Alexander Hamilton and Gouverneur Morris, they said, "Look, if we're going to get this thing going," and Hamilton actually called it a scheme. So he knew what he was doing. He called it a scheme on three different occasions in three different letters. Mm-hmm. And they said, if we're going to get this thing to work, Washington must be there. Without Washington, the people just will not give this the attention it deserves. So all of them, and especially some Revolutionary War generals, start writing to Washington, begging him to be there over and over. And he finally said, "Well, I might consider it." And so the governor of Virginia says, "Well, I'm going to put you on the list, even if you're not coming, so that others will think that you'll be there." So they were trying to give it validity because Washington had said, "Look, I can't make it. I've already got a prior engagement with the Order of the Cincinnati at the same time, so I won't be able to be there." And Madison and Hamilton and others just kept begging him, General Knox, and they kept begging him, "Please be there, please be there. We got to have you there." And finally, he said, "Yes, I'll be there." Well, as soon as they arrive, he and Hamilton and Madison and Gouverneur Morris and Robert Morris were there a week before the convention started. And so as soon as the convention got underway, they appointed Washington president of the convention. Because they knew exactly what they were doing, and they knew that with Washington there, that the people would respect the proceedings. But even with Washington there, there is no Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights was totally voted down again unanimously. So we're at this point at the end of the convention with no Bill of Rights. Any questions, guys?
Yeah, let me drop back to the money that was owed to the Bank of North America, just for a half sec, please, if I may.
Right.
Was that money that was owed based on the war or based on just general activity of government? Why was it owed to them? What constituted that bill?
Well, let's put it this way. Good question, Robert. Thank you. What happened when the war got started, the Congress under the Articles of Confederation appointed Robert Morris as the financier to be in charge of all the financial operations during the Revolutionary War. Well, Morris immediately demanded almost complete control of the government, and the Congress gave it to him. Now, you got to remember, these were the people who would later become Federalists, so they gave him complete control. So he said, one of the first things he did was he said, "Okay, we have got to establish," he even got to name the Secretary of War. He got to name almost everybody as financier. And so he appointed his assistant, which was Gouverneur Morris, no relation. He appointed him as his assistant. And he also, in one of his provisions for taking the position was that he could use the money to buy war materials from his company. So he was the financier, plus he had a company that was selling, you know, kind of like the military industrial complex of today. But to get to the money issue, Robert, what happened was they tried to raise money for the Bank of North America, which was one of the first things he proposed. They wanted to raise the bank, and this was Alexander Hamilton's idea, and it was well laid out in a letter to Duane, in last name Duane, in Boston, prior to all of these, to the war actually getting underway. So they have this Bank of North America. But what happens is France loans the United States, because they didn't like Britain, so France loans the United States $440,000 in gold. So Morris, being the head of the financier in charge of everything, he embezzles right off of the bat $270,000 out of that $400,000. He embezzles that and uses that to start the Bank of North America. So the $270,000 in gold he has, he loans that out to his friends and neighbors under the condition that they use that money to buy shares in the bank. So everybody, and I doubt any money actually changed hands. He probably just wrote them shares of the bank. So these people, not listed, but we know who some of them are. Gouverneur Morris was one of them. Robert Morris, of course, had stock in the bank. James Wilson had stock in the bank. Pardon me. So they used this $270,000, and then Morris loans that $270,000 along with the rest of the $440,000 to the U.S. government from the Bank of North America. So the U.S. government then has to pay back the interest to the Bank of North America, which goes to the stockholders.
There it is.
I promise you they will not teach that in school, Robert.
No, they're not about to do that.
Any questions, Dave?
Well, yes. As I understand it, the original taxation by the government was essentially through tariffs. Could you maybe expound upon that? And, you know, when did that all change to individual taxation or corporate taxation?
Well, we'll move into that. It's not really a good time to touch that right now, Dave. I'm not trying to avoid your question. I just want to try to keep it going in a fluid pattern, but I'll show where that comes in.
Oh, okay, great.
Well, Michael?
Yes, sir.
Michael? Yeah, since we're talking about this time period with the Revolutionary War and the finances, can you address one of the funders, or at least fundraisers, was Chaim Solomon?
Yes, he was. He obviously contributed, and there was another gentleman who was of Scottish origin who also contributed heavily, but their names were not listed, especially Mr. Chaim Solomon's name was not listed on the as a stockholder in the bank. Well, of course, none of them were listed, but we do know through some other paper trails who the ones that were that we named that were Federalists. But Chaim Solomon, at that time, who was Jewish, obviously, and at that time in America, Jews could not hold public office.
Well, I just find it interesting that in Chicago, the Windy City, there's a memorial with George Washington standing between Chaim Solomon and Robert Morris. And they're all shaking hands.
Yes, with that, and Washington and Chaim Solomon has that funny looking handshake, right?
That's right.
The thumb between the two knuckles.
It looked a little weird. Yes, and of course Robert Morris is on one side, Chaim Solomon is on the other, and that monument, I promise you, BLM hasn't torn down.
No, and they haven't took down UV Mitchell's either.
No, and that is another story. Yes, exactly. But anyway, talking about rights, so we end up at the end of the Constitutional Convention, September 17th. It's all signed, and there is no Bill of Rights. So the Federalist intention, here's something people have got to understand. The Federalist intention was to have no Bill of Rights. They did not intend for the people to have any rights whatsoever. Not the right of free speech, not the right for trial by jury, not the right to keep and bear arms, not the right to protect yourself from illegal search and seizure. None of those were to be listed. Now, they had a little scheme going here that when they were asked about it, when Luther Martin asked about the, Luther Martin was sharp. He said, what about our rights? How are the rights of the people to be protected? And James Wilson answers and says, well, you all have your state constitutions. And he said, there your rights are protected. And Luther Martin responded very quickly and said, no, because there is this thing in the Constitution called the Supremacy Clause and the Necessary and Proper Clause and the General Welfare Clause. And at any time the federal government wants to get rid of the state Bill of Rights, all they have to do is say it's necessary and proper and absolutely goes to the general welfare.
So Martin Luther, Carter. Yeah, so Luther Martin obviously understood the language very well and understood that if you had a superior, then there must be an inferior.
Well, he made that quite evident, and he, James Wilson was known as the Caledonian, and he was obviously a British sympathizer during the war, and when the Revolutionary War was going on near Philadelphia, when the Revolutionary American forces would pass by his house, they would shoot into it. That's how well known he was to be a supporter of the crown.
Wow.
All right, guys, we'll come back on the other side of the break. Thank you.
Oscar's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows you're screwed.
The blood is filling with adrenaline right now. Whether you know it or not, the heart's beating fast. It's getting a little harder to breathe. Your neurobiological system is telling it to run, but your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. Do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
Listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener supported radio. Reporting the danger. Unafraid. Right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. Radio!
Hello, all you good-looking people out there in Revolution Radio. This is Mario. I invite you to join me Thursdays at 6 o'clock for This, That, and the Other. It's a show about you, it's a show about me, but ultimately it's a show where we try to have a little bit of fun. We discuss some quirky topics, and we do our best to be apolitical. So I invite you, put on your favorite pair of comfy sweats, your smoking jacket, and grab a beverage of your choice, and join me Thursday evenings at 6 o'clock. For This, That, and the Other on Revolution Radio.
Find some comfort at Willow's World. A variety of news, commentary, and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow Mondays and Thursdays, 2 till 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Studio A.
All right, thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Welcome back, folks, to The Ultimate Remedy. And LB, if you were expecting to hear his voice, is a little under the weather, and he should be back and ready to go next week. In the meantime, we are dealing with an illustrious panel of folks here. We are dealing with the question of, do we have constitutional rights? And to put that together, we've been trying to put a little historical lean to this, to the fact that the people who created the Constitution never intended for the people to have any rights whatsoever. And I know that's going to break some people's heart, and some people are just going to refuse to believe it because they have an interminable disease called cognitive dissonance. But anyway, I need to apologize to Dave because he brought up a point that I had skipped over. And I apologize for that, Dave, and let me throw that in very quickly, that during the Constitutional Convention, although they did not want the people to have any rights, they did want the government to have the unlimited power to tax the people at for any amount that they wanted at any time they wanted for any reason they decided was necessary and proper. So that is included in the very first power given to the Congress, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. There are no limitations to the amount you can be taxed. There was no limitations on how you could be taxed. So there is the point I should have been ready to provide when you asked the question, Dave. So I apologize for that.
Well, that's okay. I'm just in class here, Mike. This is excellent. It just seemed to me like, you know, the idea of tariffs was a more, you know, a better way to tax rather than taxing the individual.
Well, that is true, but you have to understand the circumstances. And this, again, is bringing in stuff I probably should have brought in to start with. You have to understand that prior to the war, America traded primarily with Great Britain. So during the war, there was no trade going on, so there's no taxes to be collected from tariffs. And then after the war, Britain had basically shut off all trade with the U.S. So their only trading partners were France and Spain. And prior to the Constitutional Convention, Jay got in cahoots with the Spaniards and tried to shut down the Mississippi River for 30 years to the people in the western part of the colonies. Was going to make the Mississippi River off limits, which would have meant that all of the people who lived, and again, we have to remember that Virginia went all the way to the Mississippi River back then. North Carolina went all the way to the Mississippi River, and Georgia went all the way to the Mississippi River. So you have to understand, the people who lived in the western parts of those colonies, they were using the Mississippi River for shipping and for receiving their commerce. And if the Jay Gardocki Treaty, or Gardocki, whichever way you want to pronounce it, if that treaty had gone through, they would have shut down. And the New England market people, the wealthy aristocracy, the same Federalists, wanted to shut down the Mississippi River to force the people in the western parts of the states to have to bring their produce through New England ports. So they thought it was a great thing if they could shut down the Mississippi River. So that whole treaty and what happened, because we had some states at that time, including what is now what was North Carolina and Tennessee, parts of those areas were trying to actually become a part of Spain. If Jay got this treaty that he was trying to get done. So that, again, is another story. But anyway, back to the rights thing. So the Federalists have their unlimited taxation scheme. And again, scheme is a word that Hamilton used. That's not my word. So they have all of this set to go, and they have the people with no rights whatsoever. But then the Constitution gets sent out to the states, and the people in the states begin to get a look at this. And they are told all or nothing. You can't add to it. You can't do anything. It's all or nothing. You have to accept this Constitution. And if you don't accept this Constitution, we're going to have anarchy and everything is going to fall apart. Of course, you know, governments usually tell people that to get their way. So that was the story that they were told, but the people began to get a hold of this and started looking at it, and they said, hey, we have no rights. And then people like Luther Martin went to the Maryland legislature and gave them the full readout of the story. And Robert Yates and John Lansing Jr., who left the convention because they said that if they stayed, they would be exceeding the authority that the state granted them to be there. So there were two men of moral character. And so they went back to New York and they started telling the people in New York, hey, look, here's what they're trying to do up there. Because there was a reason that the people at the Constitutional Convention, these Federalists, swore each other to secrecy for 50 years. Because they didn't want the people to know what was going on. That's why they met in a building on the second floor with armed guards so people couldn't get in to hear what they were doing.
Cover up the secret.
Right. And see, this is what gets me today, is that people will readily accept that in today's world and say, oh, well, that's okay. They were inspired by God. But if somebody tried to do that today, if the Congress met in secret and nobody knew what they were doing, and they said, we're not going to talk about this for 50 years, people go wacko. But they could accept it because it happened back then. And no one is in the least bit upset that they did that. Of course, they got very angry at Luther Martin for talking about going to the Maryland legislature and saying, look, here's what they're trying to do to us. So various state legislators, Massachusetts was one of them, started insisting on a Bill of Rights. Virginia certainly insisted on a Bill of Rights. New York insisted on a Bill of Rights. Rhode Island insisted. Of course, Rhode Island didn't come right away. But these states are saying, hey, if we don't have a Bill of Rights, we're not going to ratify this thing. So then they had to promise a Bill of Rights. Pardon me.
Who said that? What state, Michael?
There was Massachusetts said there must be a Bill of Rights. Virginia said there must be a Bill of Rights. New York said there must be a Bill of Rights. North Carolina wouldn't ratify. They voted not to ratify. Rhode Island put the ratification up to a popular vote, and the people voted it down overwhelmingly. And then you had the crucial election in Virginia, because Patrick Henry saw what they were trying to do. And as a leader in the Virginia legislature, he made sure that the two senators elected from Virginia were both anti-federalist. And that was William Grayson and Richard Henry Lee. He made sure they were anti-federalist. And he also did that to keep James Madison out as a senator. And then he tried very hard to keep James Madison from being elected to the House of Representatives. But Madison defeated James Monroe in that election, campaigning on the fact, if I'm elected, I'll get you a Bill of Rights. So Madison had promised to people in Virginia a Bill of Rights, and he knew that if he didn't give the people a Bill of Rights, his political career was over in Virginia. So any questions, guys?
Well, he was telling the truth. He did get a Bill of Rights, just more toward a Bill of Goods, though.
Well, we're going to get into that here as we move along. Any questions, DW? Uh-oh. Did DW go to sleep? I guess
can
I put
you
him
hear me?
Sleep. Yeah, I can hear you now. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I got. I just got to take my mute off, huh?
Yeah.
I'm gonna wait till we get into the rights here a little bit more.
Okay. Any thoughts or questions, Dave?
No. Let's go ahead and get into the rights, and I'll join in too.
Okay. So we have the states get together and they submit their proposal for a Bill of Rights. After the Congress is together, after it's ready to go, but it's very important to note that in the Senate, the Federalists controlled the Senate. They had 20 Federalist senators to 2 Anti-Federalist senators. In the House of Representatives, there were 39 Federalists to 11 Anti-Federalists. The president was a Federalist. The entire Supreme Court was Federalist. The vice president was Federalist. Secretary of Treasury was a Federalist. The only person with anti-Federalist leanings in the cabinet was Thomas Jefferson as Secretary of State. So it was a dominant. The people who had created the Constitution in Philadelphia then ran the government that they themselves had created. And they were in control. But the states submitted their proposals for a Bill of Rights. And like Virginia divided them up. Virginia said, here, we have one list of a Bill of Rights to alter the structure of the Constitution. And we have another list of rights that we want to guarantee the liberty of the people. Now, some other states did the same thing. Some other states said, okay, we're going to do, especially New York. New York said, hey, we're going to do the same thing. But in the meantime, Patrick Henry was calling for another convention just for a Bill of Rights, a convention that would write a Bill of Rights of all the states. Of course, unfortunately, that didn't work. So because they had been promised if they sent these rights in that they would have a Bill of Rights. So all of the states sent in their rights combined. There were over 200. After a committee was appointed in the House of Representatives, after a committee was appointed to look at the rights, they first took out all of the duplicates, which was necessary. And so then they still had around 100 proposals for a Bill of Rights. And so they had the 100. And so then this committee whittles that 100 Bill of Rights, 100 listings of a Bill of Rights, whittled it down to 16. Just arbitrarily threw the others out, the committee did. Now, the committee was all Federalist. Imagine that. So they threw out all of these rights, except for 16. Then the 16 are sent to the Senate. The Senate gets rid of 2 of those and alters the wording in many of the others, which I'm going to prove with a letter here in a minute. Then the Senate did not like what the House sent them at all. Now, remember, the Senate was controlled 20-2 by Federalists. So they did not like the wording of these rights, and so they altered the wording even to the point of replacing semicolons with commas and all kind of stuff they did in the Senate. So there were 16. They put it down to 14. So then somehow that gets sent to the states, and the states ratify 10 of those, and that becomes the Bill of Rights. But it is important that we look at some correspondence here that took place during that time frame, and to look at it chronologically, I think, would be the best way to do this so that you'll get a feeling of what was going on. So first of all, let's look at a letter from Richard Henry Lee, who was a senator in Virginia, to Patrick Henry, who was kind of the leader of the legislature at that time in Virginia. And here was the letter from Richard Henry Lee. Quote, so far as this has gone, now this is the beginning. This is before they even look at the Bill of Rights. He says, so far as this has gone, I am satisfied to see a spirit prevailing that promises to send this system out free from those vexations and abuses that might have been warranted by the terms of the Constitution. See, he already says that there are vexations and abuses that could be had in the Constitution. Then he says it must never be forgotten, however, that the liberties of the people are not so safe under the gracious manner of government as by the limitation of power. So he says there something very astute, that your rights are not safe under government unless you have the power to enforce them. Then he goes on and he says, Mr. Madison has given notice that on Monday night he will call for the attention of the House to the subject of amendments. I apprehend that his ideas and those of our convention on this subject, meaning Virginia's, are not similar. We shall carefully attend to this, and when the plan comes to the Senate, we shall prepare to abridge or enlarge so as to affect, if possible, the wishes of our legislature. So he is saying we in the Senate are going to try to make sure that we adhere to what the legislature of Virginia wanted. Unfortunately, he's not realizing he's terribly outnumbered at this time. And then he goes on to say, I think from what I hear and see that many of our amendments will not succeed. But my hopes are strong that such as may effectually secure civil liberty will not be refused. As 2/3 of the legislatures have refused to apply for a general convention, the convention I mentioned that Patrick Henry was pushing, the Congress, it seems, can constitutionally only submit their propositions of amendments to the legislators or to state conventions, but I suppose neither of these modes will fail where the design is more effectually to secure civil liberty, the wish to do which was, I assure you, the sole reason that could have influenced me to come here. So Richard Henry Lee states at that point, this is in March of 1789, at the beginning of Congress, the very first Congress, he is saying the only reason I agreed to be a senator was to protect the rights of the people. Imagine that. So then let's look at how that changed. Let's go into, let's look at Patrick Henry to Richard Henry Lee in August. Now, these are after the amendments have gone through the House and the Senate, or at least the House. And Patrick Henry says, as to my opinion of the amendments, I think they will tend to injure rather than to serve the cause of liberty, provided they go no further than is proposed as ideas. For what good end can be answered by rights, the tenure of which must be during pleasure? For rights without her power and might is but a shadow. Patrick Henry says right there, the same situation we're staring in the face today. You can have all of the rights you want written on parchment, written anywhere, chiseled in stone. If you don't have the means to enforce those, you have nothing. And then he goes on to say, now it seems that it is not proposed to add this force to the rights by any amendment. So he's saying that they're going to give you the rights in writing, but there is going to be no amendment which will enforce them. It can therefore answer no purpose but to lull suspicion totally on the subject. While impediments are cast in the way of those who wish to retrench the exorbitancy of power granted away by the Constitution from the people. There he says it again. The power is granted away from the people in the Constitution. He said a fresh grant from them is made in the first moment of opportunity and of nature and extent to which full success in the business of amendments would scarcely compensate. So he is saying what we know today, even with the amendments, you can't do anything with them.
Not even the 10th.
And the 10th gets real tricky as we get into how the Senate changed the language on that one. So any thoughts on that so far, gentlemen?
I guess he's in the future.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
That stinking, pernicious window through all kinds of mischief will be allowed to pass. He saw that.
He saw it right back then. So that is... Okay, go ahead.
Well, you know, as you were reading that, I was thinking, and I've thought about it many times. How do you enforce these Bill of Rights or even arbitrate them with when there's a contest between the intent or the objectives of a federal government or even a state government? And when those are at odds in a contest with the common man's so-called rights, who's the arbitrator of this, and where are the checks and balances that were built into this balance between the Bill of Rights of the common man and the federal government? Where was those, Michael?
They're not there. And here's the thing, to draw an analogy, DW, let's say that you decide, you and I have this huge conflict somehow in business, and you decide to sue me. So you decide that to get your day in court, to get your justice, you're going to sue me. And then once you sue me, you find out that all of the jury are employed by me.
Okay.
How would you think your rights were going to be protected in that trial?
Well, you know, maybe I'm missing something here, Michael, but I would probably object under the grounds that there's a conflict of interest. Now, is that being belligerent of me?
No, it's not being belligerent, DW, but that's exactly what we face today. If you decide that you want to sue the government because they have violated your rights, if you decide that's what you want to do, who hears the case?
The government.
Or who decides not to hear your case?
The government.
The Supremes?
Yes.
The Supremes.
And so what if they tell you, okay, you can sue me over these rights all you want to, but you have no standing in my court? Now, regardless of how you want to look at this latest Supreme Court decision, that's what the Supreme Court told the people of the state of Texas and those other states. You have no standing before the federal courts. In other words, the Supreme Court told the people of Texas and the people of other states, you have no standing with this government.
You have no rights.
And that's exactly right, Robert. That's what they said. I don't see why this can't sink through people's heads.
Well, some it can, others it can't. And let me ask you this.
Yes,
did the AOs speak to possession of firearms at all?
I'm sorry, say again?
The ALC, did it speak to possession of firearms, personal handguns?
No.
Okay.
It was assumed because the states were dealing with that. The federal government felt like they had no say-so in that.
Well, that changed, didn't it?
Yeah, under the Articles of Confederation, they felt like they had that was up to the people of a state. The state could decide on those type issues.
Mm-hmm.
So now, here I think this is very instrumental. Let's go back and look at a letter from Richard Henry Lee to Patrick Henry after it's all over with the Bill of Rights. After they've already been gone through, after they've been thrown out, after they end up with just the ones they're going to send to the states, what does Richard Henry Lee say to Patrick Henry? It's a very short letter, but it is very relevant. He says, "My third letter to you on the 14th instance will satisfy you how little is to be expected from Congress that shall be any ways satisfactory on the subject of amendments. Your observation is perfectly just, that right without power to protect it is of little avail. Yet small as it is, how wonderfully scrupulous have they been in stating rights. Now listen to this. The English language has been carefully culled to find words feeble in their nature or doubtful in their meaning. Here he gives it all away that the Senate went through these and did the word check to make sure that where rights were guaranteed, it was flexible. It could be ruled either way. And, you know, again, let me read that one more time. The English language has been carefully culled to find words feeble in their nature or doubtful in their meaning. Go ahead, D.W.
Ambiguous.
Well, you know, what you're describing is equivocation or sophistry and semantics at their pleasure. So I think a parallel to what you're describing is when we have people that we observe at this time and day, every day in front of us, where they're exercising situational ethics. And I would affirm that when you're dealing with somebody who espouses situational ethics, you're dealing with a abject and bald-faced liar.
Depends on the situation.
Well, why would anyone want to go through the wordage, the verbiage of an agreement to make sure that whatever rights you might think you have are dubious in nature?
I would if I want to make sure you have none.
All right, guys, break time. We'll be back on the other side.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We gotta stop them! They're gonna kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone or human being!
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, by all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Ray, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
Hello, all
all you good-looking people out there in Revolution Radio. This is Mario. I invite you to join me Thursdays at 6 o'clock for This, That, and the Other. It's a show about you, it's a show about me, but ultimately it's a show where we try to have a little bit of fun. We discuss some quirky topics, and we do our best to be apolitical. So I invite you, put on your favorite pair of comfy sweats, your smoking jacket, and grab a beverage of your choice, and join me Thursday evenings at 6 o'clock for This, That, and the Other on Revolution Radio.
All right. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Hey, welcome back, everyone, to The Ultimate Remedy here on Revolution Radio. And let me take just a moment to tell everyone that Revolution Radio is completely listener supported. I would ask that if you have the opportunity to go to freedomslips.com and go to the donate button, and if you can find it in your heart, find some way to support probably might be the last bastion of free speech in this country. If it's not the last one, it's pretty doggone close. So I would ask you for the help there, or maybe you might find some merchandise there that you might want to purchase. But anyway, if you have the opportunity, please support this forum. Tonight we are discussing these constitutional rights that so many people believe they have that I can firmly prove, I believe, that we never had. They have been an illusion. I have described them as a pacifier that the government gave us to suck on while they robbed us blind. And I believe that the evidence here is unequivocal to that end, and I'm proving it with words of the people who were involved. And I think that is critical. We can read books, we can watch YouTubes, we can listen to people's opinions, and or we can look at the source documents and see what the people who were actually involved, what they said. And it's really important when we look at the people who really said, like Richard Henry Lee, that the only reason he was in office was to ensure that the rights of the people were protected. You heard anybody say that in a campaign speech lately? Well, anyway, no. The next thing I would like to jump to is William Grayson, who was the other anti-federalist senator from Virginia, because his last letter to Patrick Henry after the Bill of Rights was decided upon and being sent to the states for ratification, William Grayson sends a very, very valuable, in my opinion, to history letter. And again, remember, the anti-federalists were outnumbered 20-2 in the first U.S. Senate. So here is the letter, William Grayson to Patrick Henry, September 29th, 1789. And he says, and I quote, "With respect to amendments, matters have turned out exactly as I apprehended from the extraordinary doctrine of playing the after game." So here William Grayson is saying that our mistake was ever accepting a constitution to where the rights of the people were not protected within that document from the very beginning. And that's the after game. And then he goes on to say, "The lower house," which would be the House of Representatives, "sent up amendments which held out a safeguard to personal liberty in a great many instances. But this disgusted the Senate." Gosh, that's a pretty strong word. That that held up for personal liberty in a great many instances disgusted the Federalists in the Senate. Didn't just say they opposed them. He said they were disgusted by them. And he said, "And though we," which means he and Richard Henry Lee, "made every exertion to save them, they are so mutilated and gutted that in fact they are good for nothing. And I believe, as many others do, that they will do more harm than benefit." More harm than benefit. What did I just say about a grand illusion? The people believe they have rights. They think they're protected. They have nothing. And that's hard for me to say. It was hard for me to accept when I finally started reading these letters and realizing it. But now to proceed, he says, the Virginia amendments were all brought into view and regularly rejected. So people hear the amendments that were sent to protect the rights of the people were rejected by the Federalists who wrote the Constitution and who now control the First Congress. You have no rights. The only rights you have are the rights that the federal government decides to dish out from time to time if they think it will help in any instance. And the situation we're in right now in this country with everybody running around saying, look at me, I'm a slave, here, look at my mask. With everybody doing that, you have no rights. It's becoming more and more obvious because more and more and more every day. And I don't know how many times I've heard people say on social media, well, what gives the government the right to close down a business? Well, because you don't have the right to stop it. So, comments, gentlemen?
Wow. We have no rights.
That's a hard pill. I tell you, that's a hard pill to swallow.
It is.
But it
makes,
is.
Makes you choke.
But it's true.
Well, it's true, and it's becoming, you know, patently obvious now that, you know, New York actually just proposed a mandatory vaccine bill. And, you know, you don't even have the right to open your own business or do commerce without permission of the government. So, yeah.
Well, here is the thing. I wrote an article about 20 some years ago, and the title of my article was "We Are All Slaves on That Great Federal Plantation." And that is becoming more and more obvious every day. Any thoughts, DW? You figure out how to operate that mute button? Obviously not. He's not saying anything. DW.
I'm here.
Okay.
I'm here. It's the this boom mic. Every once in a while, it loses contact. So what I would say is that the present that we're living in gives evidence to the objective of the past. Throughout history, in the early 1900s, you had multiple occasions where the common man, the working man, in the factories, on the farm, was oppressed brutally and physically by not only a local police but federal troops. So, in our short memories of the present, a little walk back into history, just through the in the 1900s, will demonstrate that those people obviously didn't have constitutional rights when they're arbitrarily taken away from you or abused at will under the guise of an emergency. And so I don't know how many times this has to repeat itself. Every time it repeats itself, the abuse of the perceived right just becomes worse and worse. So I guess people are just going to have to suffer before they come to terms with it. You're going to have to come to terms with confronting the contradictions between your belief system and your worldview here. And this is what's happening now. People believe a lot of things. That doesn't mean they know anything. So just my opinion.
Well, when you look through the lens of what has happened in history, I am amazed today that people can even say it's got to be something that is rote memory, something they saw on Cops or some other TV program. Well, I have constitutional rights. Well, do you really?
Mike.
Yes.
Mike, I hear people say these things to me, or I'll watch them on different podcasts or YouTube or BitChute, and I'll hear these comments made by different podcasters, and it's like a conditioned Pavlovian response, and I just. As long as you keep yourself in the mindset you of what reality is, you could never move on to a remedy. Okay, if you're caught in a false perspective, how do you achieve a remedy? So the sooner you come to terms with it, the sooner you can take effective action. Well, hey, that's the whole point, isn't it? Isn't that the whole point of their information campaign in schooling and media? Is to keep you in a state of suspended perception. Isn't that nobody challenges it except, well, you do. And John Whitehead, he seems to, but everybody else seems to go along with it. So.
Well, we have to go back to what Mao said. And Mao said the power of politics comes out of the barrel of a gun. So it's force. The essence of government is force, and they can force you to do, because they have the might, they can force you to do any damn thing they want to. Because look what they're going to do with this vaccine. If you don't take it, you can't travel. If you don't take it, you might not be able to even go into a grocery store if you don't have the badge or the certification. They're going to force you to do what they want you to do. And to me, I've drawn the analogy that this vaccine is like this Bill of Rights that you think you have that's going to protect you from something.
It won't.
Well, when was the last time anybody, on the call here has or in the chat room, when was the last time anybody ever or can identify where a common man's constitutional rights were violated and the Supreme Court came down on the side of that man or woman? When has that ever happened?
Heller v. D.C.
What's that?
Heller.
What year was that, Robert? Or thereabouts? When was that?
It's been a while. Probably, I'm thinking 09, 02. 2010-ish, somewhere in there. It's been a while.
Robert, did you say Heller versus D.C.?
I did.
I'm about to jump on you like a chicken on a June bug.
I think I know why.
Okay, Heller versus D.C. Okay, go ahead, D.W.
Well, I was just going to say, before you do, I threw that question out there about the arbitration of constitutional rights of the common man. But how many times have you heard somebody filing a Title 42 civil rights lawsuit? Thousands and thousands and thousands, if not tens of thousands of times, they file civil rights lawsuits, not constitutional rights lawsuits. So I just want to throw that out there.
Okay, well, you would be exactly right. And let me talk with Mr. Robert here on Heller versus D.C. Now, here is where I hand you a quarter and I take your wallet. That is how the analogy I draw on Heller D.C. versus D.C. They started it off by saying, the right to keep and bear arms is an individual right. And all of the Second Amendment people all over the country got orgasmic. I mean, I saw people just, woo, wow, look at this, yay, yay. Look, they confirmed our rights. Well, you didn't read the whole damn thing, George.
George.
Because Scalia said very simply, your rights, yes, it's an individual right, but your rights are subject to reasonable restrictions.
Okay, you got me there. What about McDonald v. Cook County?
Well, that's basically the same thing because Heller versus D.C. has already said they are. But let's go back 115 years. Okay, Jacobson versus, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Yeah, what, 115 years ago, what did these black robe bandits say? Yes, you have rights, but they are subject to the police power of the state. So, in other words, if we say you don't got them, you don't got them.
That's harsh.
So your rights are open to interpretation? Is that right? Exactly.
And then that wonderful bastion of conservative government, Antonin Scalia, who may have... No, I'm not going to say that. Anyway, that wonderful bastion of conservatism, when he was asked about secession, and it said, what if a state sued and said, we have the right to secede? This is critical, people. He answered this in a private correspondence, and the guy made it available. What if we were to sue for secession rights?
What did the esteemed justice say?
Scalia said that was settled by the Civil War.
Well, I guess on one level he was right.
He didn't say anything about rights. He didn't say anything about the Constitution. He said that was settled by force. And he said, secondly, I can't imagine anyone suing the federal government because you can only sue the state with its permission.
So, Michael, what you're saying here is that Justice Scalia and Mao Zedong agree?
Oh, absolutely.
Two of a kind.
Absolutely. Right. He also said, and here's the other thing that got me about his answer, that private answer to the person who asked about suing for secession, the right to secede. He also said, look, we have the Pledge of Allegiance. He didn't bother to tell the guy that the Pledge of Allegiance was written by a Marxist socialist.
1942 yeah. or 3, wasn't it?
No, it was before that. It was before that.
Oh, that's when they added In God We Trust. Yeah,
52. In God We Trust.
52. Yeah.
Was that Bellamy?
Yes.
Yeah.
And he had been defrocked as a minister for preaching Jesus was a socialist in church. But today we have a bunch of people stand up with all the fervor of you can't even imagine. I've watched the look on their faces. I pledge allegiance.
The United States of America.
Well, hey, Michael.
Sure.
I have a question for you. And
Robert Davis
here. So prior to the Civil War, or as we know it better as the War of Northern Aggression, what kind of civil rights did the common man, the farmer, the agrarian, the mechanic, the shopkeeper, what kind of civil rights did they have then prior to the Civil War?
Many times, DW, that depended on their states. That was the state's rights issue. Many times those were decided by their state governments.
So you had state citizens that had their unique Bill of Rights, particular to that political status of being a state citizen and the that political status within that jurisdiction of the state. So their civil rights would have been in reference to their state charter. That's what you're saying?
As long as it didn't get adjudicated by the federal courts. As long as you could keep your business out of the federal courts, in your state courts, you would probably have a chance of having your rights upheld in that state court.
So in a state court, during that period of time, what kind of law would have been used to adjudicate a suit in rights in a state court?
Well, if you're looking for nomenclature, I'm not going to be able to help you.
Well, I'll settle for the general word, a general idea, and it would have been in a jury trial.
Right, and it would have depended upon the constitution of that state, and all of the constitutions of the states were not the same. That was the beauty of the whole thing.
Well, that is the basis of a republic and that sovereignty within that republic, and a trial by your peers in that state with a jury would be where they were trying, they were holding the violator of that perceived right, that being the government or an agent of the government or an agency of the government, with the individual rights of that state citizen, and that jury would have been trying been the arbitrator. They would have been the arbitrator and not the state, and not the man himself, whoever brought the suit. So you had a jury that was arbitrating. Well, what am I talking about here? I'm talking about a common law. We're talking about common law, and we're not talking about magisterial courts. And that was really the only protection. And to this day, the only protection you have is in front of a jury of your peers, and that is common law.
Well, I tell you what, if I had a trial before a jury of my peers today and they were all wearing masks, I would know I was screwed before I got there.
That's a sign of the times, right?
Yeah, but I would know these were sheep. These are not individual. These are not people who respect individual rights. They would be sheep. And that I understand what you're saying, DW, but that's the situation we're in today. Is there is no hope, because where in the world are you going to find 12 people that have a clue what rightful liberty is? Where
well,
are you going to find
them? I agree. I'm not in a, contesting that with you at all, Michael. I'm saying that the propaganda and misinformation and public fool system has worked its magic. So I mean, you're absolutely spot on. The only thing I'm trying to do here in history is see at each stage where the machinery slipped and slipped and slipped to where now the gears are all stripped off, any pretense that you have rights. So you had this common law jury prior to the Civil War with these issues. And then after the Civil War, you get this thing called civil rights under the 14th Amendment that didn't exist prior to the Civil War. Okay? So now we have, with civil rights, this can be resolved administratively and not by a jury. I find that just absolutely jaw-dropping.
Well, you are exactly correct, Darryl, but we also have to be careful with the unwashed masses of the verbiage, because you and I both know what common law means. But I promise you, if the people, the government has gotten real slick, just like they were back then with using words. Now, in many instances, if you go on any search engine and you type in common law, what is now called common law by the courts is precedent.
What they have said before.
So they perverted the word common law to mean what they want you to believe. So,
it's a mess.
It just absolutely is. Dave,
well,
have you?
I mean, it's become so bad. It's so bad that I've had people in my own circle, friends and acquaintances tell me that these edicts and decrees coming down are the law of the land. And I don't know whether to laugh or just it is such a fantastically illiterate, nonsensical comment. And they're absolutely convinced of it because they want to obey.
Got another break coming up, guys, and we'll jump in it on the other side. I hope somebody wakes Dave up.
I've got one for you, Mike, when we get back.
All right, buddy.
I'm here.
Hey, Dave.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Be evasive.
But that doesn't mean that they're telling the truth as opposed to fiction.
And Genesis chapter 6, verse 4. And there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Hey, welcome back, everyone, to the last segment of The Ultimate Remedy. And normally you would be hearing our friend L.B. Bork, but he's a bit under the weather. So I am Mike Gatti, and I have Dave Scorpio, Daryl Wayne, and Robert Hudson with us tonight, and we are discussing the mythical issue of constitutional rights. And before we went to the break, Robert, you said you had a question for me or a statement. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, you're asking when the government has come out on the side of the common man. I've got one for you. June 2018, Masterpiece Cake Shop v. Colorado Civil Rights Commission. By 72 vote, the U.S. Supreme Court came down on Jack Phillips' side, saying he did not have to make a cake for a gay wedding based on his religious position. And they buttressed his position. 7-2.
Well, that's a nice decision. Did they reimburse them for all of the money they lost for this mess?
Oh, I have no idea about that. I don't know.
Well, you know, the thing about the law, if you read the law, people who have been harmed are supposed to be made whole. That is justice. And I believe those people actually went out of business. I don't think they were made whole, Robert.
Right.
But I got your point.
Yeah.
I get your point. And so, you know, but here's the whole thing. If you're going to get people to believe in a system, every once in a while, you have to throw them a bone.
And that was
a good point.
That would be my point. What I would say, what did that really help? What right did that, did we make those people whole again? And
financially, I'm assuming, no, he probably lost quite a bit. It was probably a Pyrrhic victory. However, it was a victory nonetheless, because he stood on principle. And he won on principle.
Well, I agree with you. And you know, I am glad that, you know, my grandfather had a phrase for that. He said, even a blind hog finds an acorn every once in a while. So I'm not going to heap praises on the Supreme Court for doing what they should have done at a lower court level. But I appreciate it nonetheless.
Sure. Any
thoughts,
Mike,
Dave?
I don't want you to fell asleep. So let me throw something in here real quick.
Okay.
You know, I was kind of reflecting on what Daryl said earlier, you know, that your rights are subject to interpretation. I think that really nails it. That is exactly what we're facing and, you know, the way the system is set up. And, you know, Daryl also said that he ran into someone that said that the edicts, you know, that are handed down are law, and that is absurd, but I can even do one better. I was talking with an American lady this morning that told me she can't wait to take the vaccine so things can go back to normal. So there you go.
Well, she's assuming facts, not in evidence, I believe.
Yeah.
Pardon me. Before we run out of time here, gentlemen, there is one letter involving this rights issue during the time that amendments were being considered that I want to throw out there, and it's extremely short. But does anyone remember the gentleman Robert Morris that we mentioned earlier?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Okay, well, Robert Morris, you know, embezzled money from the government, and then he was a delegate to the convention in Philadelphia, and then he was elected a senator in the first government. So, but I thought it was really amazing if we look at a letter as a senator to another man who I believe was also a stockholder in that first bank. So Robert Morris sends a letter to Francis Hopkinson on August the 15th of 1789. Now listen very carefully to this letter, because this is a confession by Robert Morris. He says, the House of Representatives are now playing with amendments. But if they make one true, I'll hang. And then he goes on to say, poor Madison got so cursedly frightened in Virginia that I believe he has dreamed amendments ever since. Pretty short letter, but that was one heck of a confession, in my opinion. Thoughts on that, gentlemen?
Yeah, it was confession.
If they make a true amendment,
I'll hang.
I'll hang.
They didn't, and he didn't, although he probably should have.
Well, he was a senator. See, that was the thing that troubled me about this whole procedure. Here's the man, according to Samuel Bryan, who wrote as Sentinel, according to him, and he has his essays 18 through 24 are pretty much an indictment of Robert Morris and the Federalists. And he called what they did in Philadelphia a criminal conspiracy, and by actual words, he was exactly right. But he said that Robert Morris saw a profit of somewhere in the neighborhood of $17 million on this venture.
That's a profit.
So here's the man who embezzled money. Now, somebody had to know he embezzled this money to start that bank. But if they were all thieves like him, no one's going to turn him in.
No.
Especially if they profited from the theft. So is it possible that the Constitutional Convention was staffed with a bunch of people who had made money on the Revolutionary War?
Sounds like it was.
Well, we know Morris was there. We know his assistant, Gouverneur Morris, was there.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I think the people who had committed the fraud and had caused the money that the America owed, I believe they're the ones who drew up the Constitution.
Michael, go ahead, Robert.
Just real quick, that was the Bank of North America that he started?
The Bank of North America, yes, sir.
Okay.
The first.
The first Federal Reserve.
I have a question for you. Yeah. Bank of the United States, the bus. So the question goes back to some fundamentals here.
Wait just a second. Wait just a second, DW. That was the Bank of North America. The Bank of the United States was the one that Hamilton did after the first Congress started.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you. The men that signed the Declaration of Independence, a lot of those men suffered a pretty terrible fate. Is that not correct? A lot of them lost all their property and were killed in the war, right?
That would be true. Yes, but a lot of them, a lot of them didn't.
And a lot of those men, the premise for fighting that, we know had a commercial aspect, undoubtedly. But then, is it safe to say, or can we define or determine whether a lot of these men were fighting for liberty as well, liberty and freedom?
Well, I think they were, but I think the ones that were fighting for liberty and freedom, with the exception of maybe Patrick Henry, and Patrick Henry was actually had a battalion called the Culpeper Battalion, but he was elected governor of the state of Virginia at the beginning of the war, and he didn't get to serve, actually. But you have to remember, guys, the Newburgh revolt, which was the generals from the Revolutionary War were getting ready to overthrow the government. Don't forget that Newburgh Convention, because you can't depend on these on the generals. You can't depend on them for being, because that Newburgh convention where they were preparing to overthrow the government and establish a military dictatorship after the Revolutionary War. That's scary. Maybe we ought to get into that at some point.
Yeah, that'd be great. We almost turned into a banana republic right out of the gate, huh? So here's the point I've tried to make several times with people.
Go ahead.
Well, the point I've tried to make with any number of people is that the men who signed the Declaration of Independence and fought were different than the men that convened at the Constitutional Convention and brought forth the Constitution for the United States. Okay. And
I made a point today on social media, and I would like you gentlemen to comment on this. I made a point on social media today that the Constitutional Convention, the Federalists who met in Philadelphia in 1787, met there to defend the wealthy aristocracy from the tenets of the Declaration of Independence.
Well, you wouldn't get any argument for me. I have to throw this out here to you. So they were actually monarchists, masquerading as Federalists. But couldn't it actually be said, because there wasn't a royal bloodline, couldn't it actually be said that they were the original corporatists? They wanted a corporate aristocracy?
Well, in many respects, I think you're right. But I when we think about Federalist and Anti-Federalist, I can't help but think of Elbridge Gerry. Elbridge Gerry said, you know, who refused to sign the Constitution, he made the statement that they never should have been called Federalist and Anti-Federalist, because that gave the wrong connotation, because they certainly were not Federalists. They were nationalists at the least and monarchist at the worst. And he said that actually they should have been called rats and anti-rats.
Right. So there's a reason why the original Constitution was named the Articles of Confederation. And so there must be a very strong distinction between a confederation and a federation. And I think this is really lost on almost everybody.
I would agree. Terminology, you know, if we're going to get into terminology, one of the most misused phrases I've ever heard is a republic. And we've got this wonderful story about Benjamin Franklin. What kind of government do you have? Well, I've got a republic if you can keep it. Well, people, you didn't have a republic. That just because Ben Franklin said you did doesn't mean you do. But the thing of it, so many people forget, is what does the R in USSR, the last R, what did that stand for?
Republic.
Okay. Reagan? No, Reagan.
And you've got the people. You've got the People's Republic of China. You've got the People's Republic of North Korea. People, a republic is not a magic bean.
No. Well, what was Rome, Michael? Rome.
It was a republic.
It was a republic.
Exactly. But they were free in the beginning. When they were a moral people, they were free, were they not?
Well, until they got a government.
Until they became decadent, amoral,
right. Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of where we are now.
Well, Robert, I know you're on my study group called Teach Me. Did you read that letter about that I posted last night from right after the Constitutional Convention?
I think I missed it. I'll have to go back and see it. Let's see here. Got my phone.
It was most relevant to this situation, especially emanating just a short time after the Constitution was signed. Do you have that handy?
I think I do. Let's see. Proposal for reviewing Christian conviction?
Yes. How beautiful that was.
Yeah. I need to read it since you pointed it out.
That, to me, that probably said almost more than anything else. And I promise you, you're not going to get that in your civics class.
No.
But he talked about Christian virtue and how without that, it was going to be nothing. And he made a great point. He made it much more eloquently than I ever could.
Mm-hmm. Now, the AOC was never deleted. It's still in vogue, is it not? It was just covered up. Would that be fair to say?
Well, here's the thing that most people can't understand, is that the fact that while the Constitutional Convention was going on, the people at the Constitutional Convention were violating the Constitution of the day.
Mm.
And my question has always been this: can you act unlawfully to create a lawful document?
No.
And well, when I ask people that, their eyes glaze over, because the Articles of Confederation, Article 2 and Article 5 and Article 13, were totally violated by the people at the Constitutional Convention.
Mm-hmm.
So they were violating the Constitution of the day to create the Constitution they wanted.
Yeah.
Would everybody in America be okay today if Joe Biden says, okay, I'm sending a bunch of people to a secret meeting this summer and they're going to come up with a new document? Would everybody love that?
No, sir.
Well, they already did that. It's at the UN. They did it at the UN.
Well, that's true. That's true. But you open a big old keg of worms there.
Well, I'm sorry.
Well, that's okay. I don't mind opening up keg of worms.
Yeah.
But that's been my whole point for years now, trying to reason with people. How can you do that? How can you accept a document that was created unconstitutionally?
Excellent question.
Well, I think I have an answer.
Okay.
Enlighten us.
I think you can justify it when you don't have any other recourse. And you want to accept the idea that the benefits of being a US citizen, this is how I phrase it to people, is that the benefits of being a U.S. citizen are that you can believe a lie in good conscience. And at all costs, they want to retain a sense and a perspective of moral certitude and high ground. And in order to do that, you have to believe a lie because you don't really have any other option. And when you look inside of your brain or your heart, you know that you don't have any other recourse. And this is why you fall dependent upon immoral actors, criminals, and appeal to them. And so if you had rights, you could demand them. And since you don't, you just appeal. You appeal to the sensibilities of criminals. And I've never aware of any case throughout all of history where criminals held themselves accountable. It's never happened, and I don't believe it ever will. So,
well, Patrick Henry made that point at the Virginia Ratification Convention. He said, "When in the history of man have people ever held themselves accountable for the crimes they commit?"
I'd have to agree.
Dave, where you at, Dave?
No, I'm here. I'm just taking this in. This is very interesting.
It is. It is. You got a great teacher, all.
Well, we do, and we're going to have to come to terms with how this has been represented. You know, we're going to have to confront the contradictions, and time is short because. Well, they intend to write a new constitution, and they're gonna change it again.
Well,
I believe they already have. They
Yeah. My question would be, why do they need to write a new one?
Yeah.
Why? All they got to do is just keep doing what they're doing, because everybody has faithfully got down on their knees and put on their mask and said, okay, you know, please bless me with a few crumbs.
All right. Thank you, sir. I have another.
Well, I've been saying for a long time here, well, and loudly for the last year, it's coming up on a year now, I've been saying that the most dangerous enemy adversary that we face at this moment is my neighbors complying with tyranny. And so the real tyranny is coming from the body of the population, because they're complying. Because I can assure you that if enough people didn't comply, they couldn't enforce it. And this just points out just how vulnerable and inadequate people are in their understanding of their own authority. And they've been completely demoralized from taking any action, physical action, or exercising any authority. And they've actually abused their own, if you want to call it, the Bill of Rights, because they haven't exercised the authority. And I just want to say this before, because time's getting short. If you think you have a right and you haven't exercised a duty to be belligerent in defending that right, then you have abused your own rights that you claim you have. And of course, this makes people mad because I'm pointing out that there is a level of cowardice in the character, and this herd mentality. And I guess we're just going to have to suffer through this wherever it goes. So,
well, I believe, and I know I'm not going to make a lot of friends with this, and you guys know how much I worry about making friends. But here, I believe, is the point. This whole thing is going to boil down to one very simple thing. Will the people who wear uniforms and badges defend the criminals or the people?
Right.
Good point.
Well, we know that. The enforcers and the order followers. So you notice that they changed their language in the 60s. They went from peace officers to law enforcement officers. And they are they're the attack dogs. And they've been working for the same people that the military's been working for all these since the Civil War, if you will.
Well, I've noticed one thing, Darrell. I've noticed that when one of them is killed in the line of duty, they switch back to being a peace officer.
That's interesting. I hadn't really picked up on that.
Look at that. Look at what they are called, law enforcement officers, until they perish in the line of duty. Then they are esteemed as peace officers.
Well, I also have to throw in here, short on time, but if you're an enforcer, you have qualified immunity. And what I found throughout my life experience here is that when you get any kind of immunity, almost everybody that gets that will act with impunity. And this is authoritative power of a petty dictator. And until they're held accountable, and the government's not going to hold them accountable because they want them to have that immunity so that they will be special and they can wear can wear their scare wear and battle rattle and and they're part of that elite class. They want to be elite. It's just like pinning medals on military people. Okay. They'll kill people so they can get medals.
All right, guys, we're running down on time here, but you're exactly correct. And, guys, I can't thank you enough for being here tonight with us. Thank you, Robert. Appreciate you, brother. Thanks, Daryl, and thanks, Dave. You got any last words for us, Dave?
Just that I think that Daryl was hitting on an essential point of basic human nature.
Yeah.
Well, guys, do not forget, those of you with badges and uniforms, do not forget that we had this thing called the Nuremberg Trials, where a lot of people were hanged for just doing their job, following orders and doing their job. That does not absolve you from crime.
Well, I just want to throw out there a recommendation to anybody who's listening is that you're probably on a list, so don't worry about that. Just make sure you make your own list.
That's for sure. Hey, guys, thanks so much. Appreciate you.
Thank you, Mike.
Have a good one. Take care, everyone.
Dave.
Great show, guys.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.